Was it Angleton at the farm? It was, wasn't it? Sly rose-growing bastard that he is. I'm just me, I said, and I probably don't know as much as you'd think. But yes, I know enough to make the Bureau look bad. How Lee told me he came right out and told you that he was gonna shoot Kennedy, for instance. Hostie stubbed out his cigarette hard enough to send up a fountain of sparks. Some landed on the back of his hand, but he didn't seem to feel them.
That's a fucking lie!
I know, I said, and I'll tell it with a straight face if you force me to. Has the idea of getting rid of me come up yet, Hostie?
Spare me the comic book stuff. We don't kill people.
Tell it to the Diem brothers over in Vietnam. He was looking at me the way a man might look at a seemingly inoffensive mouse that had suddenly bitten, and with big teeth.
How do you know America had anything to do with the Diem brothers? According to what I read in the papers, our hands are clean.
Let's not get off the subject. The thing is, right now, I'm too popular to kill. Or am I wrong?
No one wants to kill you, Amberson. And no one wants to poke holes in your story.
He barked an unamused laugh.
If we started doing that, the whole thing would unravel. That's how thin it is.
Romance at short notice was her specialty, I said.
Huh?
H.H. Monroe, also known as Saki. The story is called The Open Window. Look it up. When it comes to the art of creating bullshit on the spur of the moment, it's very instructive. He scanned me, his shrewd little eyes worried.
I don't understand you at all. That concerns me.
In the west, out toward Midland, where the oil wells thump without surcease and the gas flares dim the stars, more thunder rumbled. What do you want from me? I asked.
I think that when we trace you back a little farther from Darren or Derry or whatever it is, we're going to find nothing. As if you stepped right out of thin air.
This was so close to the truth it nearly took my breath away.
What we want is for you to go back to the nowhere you came from. The scandal press will gin up the usual nasty speculations and conspiracy theories, but we can guarantee you that you'll come out of this looking pretty good, if you even care about such things, that is. Marina Oswald will support your story, right down the line.
You've already spoken to her, I take it.
You take it right. She knows she'll be deported if she doesn't play ball. The gentlemen of the press haven't had a very good look at you. The photos that show up in tomorrow's papers are going to be little more than blurs.
I knew he was right. I'd been exposed to the cameras only on that one quick walk down the hall to Chief Curry's office, and Fritz and Hostie, both big men, had had me under the arms, blocking the best photo sight lines. Also, I'd had my head down because the lights were so bright. There were plenty of pictures of me and Jody, even a portrait shot in the yearbook from the year I'd taught there full-time, but in this era before JPEGs, or even faxes, it would be Tuesday or Wednesday of next week before they could be found and published.
"Here's a story for you," Hostie said. "You like stories, don't you? Things like this open window?"
I'm an English teacher. I love stories.
"This fellow, George Amberson, is so stunned with grief over the loss of his girlfriend."
Fiancé,
right, even better. "He's so grief-stricken that he ditches the whole works and simply disappears. Wants nothing to do with publicity, free champagne, medals from the president, or ticker tape parades. He just wants to get away and mourn his loss in privacy. That's the kind of story Americans like. They see it on TV all the time. Instead of The Open Window, it's called The Modest Hero. And there's this FBI agent who's willing to back up every word and even read a statement that you left behind. How does that sound?
It sounded like manna from heaven, but I held on to my poker face. You must be awfully sure I can disappear.
We are.
And you really mean it? Would you tell me I won't be disappearing to the bottom of the Trinity River as per the director's orders?
Nothing like that.
He smiled. It was meant to be reassuring, but it made me think of an old line from my teenage years. Don't worry, you won't get pregnant. I had the mumps when I was 14.
Because I might have left a little insurance, Agent Hostie.
One eyelid twitched. It was the only sign the idea distressed him.
We think you can disappear, because we believe, let's just say, you could call on assistance once you were clear of Dallas.
No press conference.
Well, that's the last thing we want.
He opened his briefcase again. From it, he took a yellow legal pad. He passed it over to me, along with a pen from his breast pocket.
Write me a letter, Amberson. It'll be Fritz and me who'll find it tomorrow morning when we come to pick you up, but you can head it. To whom it may concern. Make it good. Make it genius. You can do that, can't you?
Sure, I said. Romance at short notice is my specialty. He grinned without humor and picked up the champagne bottle.
Maybe I'll try a little of this while you're romancing. None for you, after all. You're going to have a busy night. Miles to go before you sleep and all that.
I wrote carefully, but it didn't take long. In a case like this, not that there had ever, in the whole history of the world, been a case exactly like this, I thought shorter was better. I kept Hostie's modest hero idea foremost in my mind. I was very glad that I'd had a chance to sleep for a few hours. Such rest as I'd managed had been shot through with baleful dreams, but my head was relatively clear. By the time I finished, Hostie was on his third glass of bubbly. He had taken a number of items from his briefcase and placed them on the coffee table. I handed him the pad, and he began reading over what I'd written. Outside, the thunder rumbled again, and lightning briefly lit the night sky. But I thought the storm was still distant. While he read, I examined the stuff on the coffee table. There was my Timex, the one item that for some reason hadn't been returned with the rest of my personal effects when we left the cop shop. There was a pair of horn-rimmed spectacles. I picked them up and tried them on. The lenses were plain glass. There was a key with a hollow barrel instead of notches, an envelope containing what looked like about $1,000 in used 20s and 50s, a hairnet, and a white uniform in two pieces, pants and tunic. The cotton cloth looked as thin as Hostie had claimed my story to be.
"This letter's good,"
Hostie said, putting the pad down.
"You come across kind of sad, like Richard Kimball. On The Fugitive, you watch that one?"
I'd seen the movie version with Tommy Lee Jones, but this hardly seemed the time to bring it up.
"No." "You'll be a fugitive, all right, but only from the press, and an American public that's going to want to know all about you. From what kind of juice you drink in the morning, to the waist size of your skivvies. You're a human interest story, Amberson. But you're not police business. You didn't shoot your girlfriend. You didn't even shoot Oswald."
"I tried. If I hadn't missed, she'd still be alive."
"I wouldn't blame yourself too much on that score. That's a big room up there, and a .38 doesn't have much accuracy from a distance."
True, you had to get within 15 yards. So I had been told, and more than once. But I didn't say so. I thought my brief acquaintanceship with Special Agent James Hostie was almost over. Basically, I couldn't wait.
"You're clean. All you need to do is to get to some place where your people can pick you up and fly you away to Spook Neverland. Can you manage that?
Neverland, in my case, was a rabbit hole that would transport me 48 years into the future, assuming the rabbit hole was still there. I believe I'll be okay.
You better be, because if you try to hurt us, it'll come back on you double. Mr. Hoover, let's just say that the director is not a forgiving man.
Tell me how I'm getting out of the hotel.
You'll put on those kitchen whites, the glasses, and the hairnet. The key runs the service elevator. It'll take you to B1. You walk straight through the kitchen and out the back door. You with me so far?
Yes.
There'll be a bureau car waiting for you. Get in the back seat. You don't talk to the driver. This ain't no limousine service. Off you go to the bus station. Your driver can offer you one of three tickets. Tampa at 11:40, Little Rock at 11:50, or Albuquerque at 20 past midnight. I don't want to know which one. All you need to know is that's where our association ends. Your responsibility to stay out of sight becomes all your own, and whoever it is you work for, of course.
Of course.
The telephone rang. If it's some smart-ass reporter who found a way to ring through, get rid of him,
Hostie said.
And if you say a word about me being here, I'll cut your throat.
I thought he was joking about that, but wasn't entirely sure. I picked up the phone. I don't know who this is, but I'm pretty tired right now, so... The breathy voice on the other end said she wouldn't keep me long. To Hostie, I mouthed, Jackie Kennedy. He nodded and poured a little more of my champagne. I turned away as if by presenting Hostie with my back I could keep him from overhearing the conversation. Mrs. Kennedy, you really didn't have to call, I said, but I'm honored to hear from you just the same.
I wanted to thank you for what you did, she said. I know that my husband has already thanked you on our behalf, but... Mr. Amberson, the First Lady began to cry. I wanted to thank you on behalf of our children who were able to say goodnight to their mother and dad on the phone tonight.
Carolyn and John John, they'd never crossed my mind until that moment.
Mrs. Kennedy, you're more than welcome. I understand. The young woman who died was to become your wife.
That's right.
You must be heartbroken. Please accept my condolences. They aren't enough, I know that. But they are all I have to offer.
Thank you.
If I could change it, if in any way I could turn back the clock.
No, I thought, that's my job, Miss Jackie.
I understand. Thank you.
We talked a little longer. This call was much more difficult than the one with Kennedy at the police station, partly because that one had felt like a dream and this one didn't. But mostly, I think it was the residual fear I heard in Jacqueline Kennedy's voice. She truly seemed to understand what a narrow escape they'd had. I'd gotten no sense of that from the man himself. He seemed to believe he was providentially lucky, blessed, maybe even immortal. Toward the end of the conversation, I remember asking her to make sure her husband quit riding in open cars for the duration of his presidency. She said I could count on that, then thanked me one more time. I told her she was welcome one more time, then hung up the phone. When I turned around, I saw I had the room to myself. At some point while I'd been talking to Jacqueline Kennedy, Hostie had left. All that remained of him were two butts in the ashtray, a half-finished glass of champagne, and another scribbled note lying beside the yellow legal pad with my To Whom It May Concern letter on it.
Get rid of the bug before you go into the bus station, it read.
And below that?
Good luck, Amberson. Very sorry for your loss. H.
Maybe he was. But sorry is cheap, isn't it? Sorry is so cheap.
I put on my kitchen potboy disguise and rode down to B1 in an elevator that smelled like chicken soup, barbecue sauce, and Jack Daniels. When the doors opened, I walked briskly through the steamy, fragrant kitchen. I don't think anyone so much as looked at me. I came out in an alley where a couple of winos were picking through a trash bin. They didn't look at me either, although they glanced up when sheet lightning momentarily brightened the sky. A nondescript Ford sedan was idling at the mouth of the alley. I got into the back seat, and off we went. The man behind the wheel said only one thing before pulling up to the Greyhound station.
Looks like rain.
He offered me 3 tickets like a poor man's poker hand. I took the one for Little Rock. I had about an hour. I went into the gift shop and bought a cheap suitcase. If all went well, I'd eventually have something to put in it. I wouldn't need much. I had all sorts of clothes at my house in Sabattis, and although that particular domicile was almost 50 years in the future, I hoped to be there in less than a week. A paradox Einstein could love. And it never crossed my tired, grieving mind that, given the butterfly effect, it almost certainly would no longer be mine, if it was there at all. I also bought a newspaper, an extra edition of the Slimes Herald. There was a single photo, maybe snapped by a professional, more likely by some lucky bystander. It showed Kennedy bent over the woman I'd been talking to not long ago, the woman who'd had no blood stains on her pink suit when she'd finally taken it off this evening. John F. Kennedy shields his wife with his body as the presidential limo speeds away from what was nearly a national catastrophe, the caption read. Above this was a headline in 36-point type. There was room, because it was only one word. Saved. I turned to page 2 and was confronted with another picture. This one was of Sadie, looking impossibly young and impossibly beautiful. She was smiling. I have my whole life ahead of me, the smile said. Sitting in one of the slatted wooden chairs while late-night travelers surged around me and babies cried and servicemen with duffels laughed and businessmen got shines and the overhead speakers announced arrivals and departures, I carefully folded the newsprint around the borders of that picture so I could remove it from the page without tearing her face. When that much was accomplished, I looked at it for a long time, then folded it into my wallet. The rest of the paper I threw away. There was nothing in it I wanted to read. Boarding for the bus to Little Rock was called at 11:20, and I joined the crowd clustering around the proper door. Other than wearing the fake glasses, I made no attempt to hide my face, but no one looked at me with any particular interest. I was just one more cell in the bloodstream of Transit America, no more important than any other. I changed your lives today, I thought, as I watched those present at the turning of the day. But there was no triumph or wonder in the idea. It seemed to have no emotional charge at all, either positive or negative. I got on the bus and sat near the back. There were a lot of guys in uniform ahead of me, probably bound for Little Rock Air Force Base. If not for what we'd done today, some of them would have died in Vietnam. Others would have come home maimed. And now, who knew? The bus pulled out. When we left Dallas, the thunder was louder and the lightning brighter, but there was still no rain. By the time we reached Sulphur Springs, the threatening storm was behind us and the stars were out in their tens of thousands, brilliant as ice chips and twice as cold. I looked at them for a while, then leaned back, shut my eyes, and listened to the big dog's tires eating up Interstate 30. Sadie, the tires sang.
Sadie, Sadie, Sadie.
At last, sometime after 2 in the morning, I slept. In Little Rock, I bought a ticket on the noon bus to Pittsburgh with a single stop in Indianapolis. I had breakfast in the depot diner near an old fellow who ate with a portable radio in front of him on the table. It was large and covered with shiny dials. The major story was still the attempted assassination, of course, and Sadie? Sadie was big, big news. She was to be given a state funeral, followed by interment at Arlington National Cemetery. There was speculation that JFK himself would deliver the eulogy. In related developments, Miss Dunhill's fiancé, George Amberson, also of Jody, Texas, had been scheduled to appear before the press at 10 a.m., but that had been pushed back to late afternoon, no reason given. Hostie was providing me all the room to run that he possibly could. Good for me. Him too, of course. And his precious director. The president and his heroic saviors aren't the only news coming out of Texas this morning, the old Duffer's radio said. And I paused, with a cup of black coffee suspended halfway between the saucer and my lips. There was a sour tingle in my mouth that I'd come to recognize. A psychologist might have termed it presque-vous, the sense people sometimes get that something amazing is about to happen, but my name for it was much more humble, a harmony. At the height of a thunderstorm, shortly after 1 a.m., a freak tornado touched down in Fort Worth, destroying a Montgomery Ward warehouse and a dozen homes. 2 people are known dead, and 4 are missing. The 2 of the houses were 2703 and 2706 Mercedes Street, I had no doubt. An angry wind had erased them, like a bad equation. Chapter 30. I stepped off my final Greyhound at the Minot Avenue station in Auburn, Maine, at a little past noon on the 26th of November. After more than 80 hours of almost non-stop riding, relieved only by short intervals of sleep, I felt like a figment of my own imagination. It was cold. God was clearing his throat and spitting casual snow from a dirty gray sky. I had bought some jeans and a couple of blue chambray work shirts to replace the kitchen whites, but such clothes weren't nearly enough. I had forgotten the Maine weather during my time in Texas, but my body remembered in a hurry and started to shiver. I made Louis for Men my first stop, where I found a sheepskin-lined coat in my size and took it to the clerk. He put down his copy of the Lewiston Sun to wait on me, and I saw my picture. Yes, the one from the DCHS yearbook, on the front page. "Where is George Amberson?" the headline demanded. The clerk rang up the sale and scribbled me a receipt. I tapped my picture. "What in the world do you suppose is up with that guy?" The clerk looked at me and shrugged. "He doesn't want the publicity, and I don't blame him. I love my wife a whole darn bunch, and if she died sudden, I wouldn't want people taking my picture for the papers, or putting my weepy mug on TV, would you?" "No," I said, "I guess not." "If I were that guy, I wouldn't come up for air until 1970. Let the ruckus die down. How about a nice cap to go with that coat? I got some flannel ones that just came in yesterday. The ear flaps are good and thick." So I bought a cap to go with my new coat. Then I limped the 2 blocks back to the bus station, swinging my suitcase at the end of my good arm. Part of me wanted to go to Lisbon Falls right that minute and make sure the rabbit hole was still there. But if it was, I'd use it. I wouldn't be able to resist. And after 5 years in the land of a go, the rational part of me knew I wasn't ready for the full-on assault of what had become, in my mind, the land of ahead. I needed some rest first. Real rest, not dozing in a bus seat while little kids wailed and tipsy men laughed. There were four or five taxis parked on the curb in snow that was now swirling instead of just spitting. I got into the first one, relishing the warm breath from the heater. The cabbie turned around, a fat guy with a badge reading licensed livery on his battered cap. He was a complete stranger to me, but I knew that when he turned on the radio, it would be turned to WJAB out of Portland. And when he dragged his ciggies out of his breast pocket, they would be lucky strikes. What goes around comes around. "Where to, Chief?" I told him to take me to the Tamarack Motor Court out on 196. "You got it." He turned on the radio and got the Miracles singing Mickey's Monkey. "These modern dances," he grunted, grabbing his smokes. "They don't do nothing but teach the kids how to bump and wiggle." "Dancing is life," I said. It was a different desk clerk, but she gave me the same room. Of course she did. The rate was a little higher, and the old TV had been replaced by a newer one, but the same sign was propped against the rabbit ears on top. "Do not use tin foil." The reception was still shitty. There was no news, only soap operas. I turned it off. I put the Do Not Disturb sign on the door. I drew the curtains. Then I stripped and crawled into bed, where, aside from a dreamlike stumble to the bathroom to relieve my bladder, I slept for 12 hours. When I woke up, it was the middle of the night. The power was off, and a strong northwest wind was blowing outside. A brilliant crescent moon rode high in the sky. I got the extra blanket from the closet and slept for another 5 hours. When I woke up, dawn lit the Tamarack Motor Court with the clear hues and shadows of a National Geographic photograph. There was frost on the cars pulled up in front of a scattering of units, and I could see my breath. I tried the phone, expecting nothing, but a young man in the office answered promptly, although he sounded as if he were still half asleep. "Sure," he said, "the phones were fine, and he'd be happy to call me a taxi. Where did I want to go?" "Lisbon Falls," I told him. "Corner of Main Street and the old Lewiston Road." "The fruit?" he asked. I'd been away so long that for a moment it seemed like a total non sequitur. Then it clicked. "That's right, the Kennebec fruit." "Going home," I told myself. "God, help me. I'm going home." Only that was wrong. 2011 wasn't home, and I would only be staying there a short time. Assuming that was I could get there at all. Perhaps only minutes. Jody was home now, or would be, once Sadie arrived there. Sadie, the virgin. Sadie, with her long legs and long hair, and her propensity to trip over anything that might be in the way. Only, at the critical moment, I was the one who had taken the fall. Sadie, with her unmarked face. She was home. That morning's taxi driver was a solidly built woman in her 50s, bundled into an old black parka and wearing a Red Sox hat instead of one with a badge reading licensed livery. As we turned left onto 196 in the direction of the falls, she said, "Did you hear the news? I bet you didn't. The power's off up this way, isn't it?" "What news is that?" I asked, although a dreadful certainty had already stolen into my bones. Kennedy was dead. I didn't know if it had been an accident, a heart attack, or an assassination after all, but he was dead. The past was obdurate, and Kennedy was dead. "Earthquake in Los Angeles. People been saying for years that California was just going to drop off into the ocean, and it seems like maybe they're going to turn out to be right." She shook her head. "I ain't going to say it's because of the loose way they live, those movie stars and all, but I'm a pretty good Baptist, and I ain't going to say it's not." We were passing the Lisbon drive-in now. "Closed for the season," the marquee read. "See you with lots more in 64. How bad was it? They're saying 7,000 dead. But when you hear a number like that, you know, it'll go higher. Most of the damn bridges fell down. The freeways are in pieces, and there's fires everywhere. Seems like the part of town where the Negroes live was pretty much burnt flat. Warts. Ain't that a hell of a name for a part of a town? I mean, even one where black folks live. Warts? Huh? I didn't reply. I was thinking of Rags, the puppy we'd had when I was 9 and still living in Wisconsin. I was allowed to play with him in the backyard on school mornings until the bus came. I was teaching him to sit, fetch, roll over, stuff like that. And he was learning. Smart puppy. I loved him a lot. When the bus came, I was supposed to close the backyard gate before I ran to get on board. Rags always laid down on the kitchen stoop. My mother would call him in and feed him breakfast after she got back from taking my dad to the local train station. I always remembered to close the gate, or at least I don't remember ever forgetting to do it. But one day, when I came home from school, my mother told me Rags was dead. He'd been in the street, and a delivery truck had run him down. She never reproached me with her mouth, not once, but she reproached me with her eyes, because she had loved Rags too. "I closed them in like always," I said through my tears. And, as I say, I believe that I did, maybe because I always had. That evening, my dad and I buried him in the backyard. "Probably not legal," Dad said, "but I won't tell if you won't." I lay awake for a long, long time that night, haunted by what I couldn't remember and terrified of what I might have done. Not to mention, guilty. That guilt lingered a long time, a year or more. If I could have remembered for sure, one way or the other, I'm positive it would have left me more quickly, but I couldn't. Had I shut the gate or hadn't I? Again and again I cast my mind to my puppy's final morning and could remember nothing clearly except heaving his rawhide strip and yelling, "Fetch, Rags! Fetch!" It was like that on my taxi ride to the falls. First, I tried to tell myself that there always had been an earthquake in late November of 1963. It was just one of those factoids, like the attempted assassination of Edwin Walker, that I had missed. As I'd told Al Templeton, I majored in English, not history. It wouldn't wash. If an earthquake like that had happened in the America I'd lived in before going down the rabbit hole, I would have known. There were far bigger disasters. The Indian Ocean tsunami of 2004 killed over 200,000. But 7,000 was a big number for America, more than twice as many fatalities as had occurred on 9/11. Next, I asked myself how what I'd done in Dallas could possibly have caused what this sturdy woman claimed had happened in L.A. The only answer I could come up with was the butterfly effect. But how could it kick into gear so soon? No way. Absolutely not. There was no conceivable chain of cause and effect between the two events. And still, a deep part of my mind whispered, "You did this. You caused Rags' death by either leaving the backyard gate open or not closing it firmly enough to latch, and you caused this. You and Al spouted a lot of noble talk about saving thousands of lives in Vietnam, but this is your first real contribution to the new history. 7,000 dead in L.A. It simply couldn't be. Even if it was. "There's no downside," Al had said. "If things turn to shit, you just take it all back. Easy as erasing a dirty word off a chalkboard." "Mister," my driver said, "we're here." She turned to look at me curiously. "We've been here for almost 3 minutes. Little early for shopping, though. Are you sure this is where you want to be?" I only knew this was where I had to be. I paid what was on the meter, added a generous tip. It was the FBI's money, after all. wished her a nice day, and got out. Lisbon Falls was as stinky as ever, but at least the power was on. The blinker at the intersection was flashing as it swung in the northwest wind. The Kennebec fruit was dark, the front window still empty of the apples, oranges, and bananas that would be displayed there later on. The sign hanging in the door of the green front read, "Will open at 10 a.m. A few cars moved on Main Street, and a few pedestrians scuttled along with their collars turned up. Across the street, however, the Warumbo Mill was fully operational. I could hear the shahoosh, shahoosh of the weaving flats, even from where I was standing. Then I heard something else. Someone was calling me, although not by either of my names.
Jimla! Hey, Jimla!
I turned toward the mill thinking, he's back. The yellow card man is back from the dead just like President Kennedy. Only it wasn't the yellow card man, any more than the taxi driver who'd picked me up at the bus station was the same one who'd taken me from Lisbon Falls to the Tamarack Motor Court in 1958. Except the two drivers were almost the same, because the past harmonizes, and the man across the street was similar to the one who'd asked me for a buck because it was double money day at the green front. He was a lot younger than the yellow card man, and his black overcoat was newer and cleaner, but it was almost the same coat.
Jimla, over here, he beckoned.
The wind flapped the hem of the overcoat. It made the sign to his left swing on its chain the way the blinker was swinging on its wire. I could still read it, though. No admittance beyond this point until sewer pipe is repaired. 5 years, I thought, and that pesky sewer pipe still busted.
Jimla, don't make me come over there and get you.
He probably could. His suicidal predecessor had been able to make it all the way to the green front. But I felt sure that if I went limping down the old Lewiston Road fast enough, this new version would be out of luck. He might be able to follow me to the red and white supermarket where Al had bought his meat, but if I made it as far as Titus Chevron or the Jolly White Elephant, I could turn around and thumb my nose at him. He was stuck near the rabbit hole. If he hadn't been, I would have seen him in Dallas. I knew it as surely as I knew that gravity keeps folks from floating into outer space. As if to confirm this, he called,
"Jimla, please!"
The desperation I saw in his face was like the wind, thin, but somehow relentless. I looked both ways for traffic, saw none, and crossed the street to where he stood. As I approached, I saw two other differences. Like his predecessor, he was wearing a fedora, but it was clean instead of filthy, and, as with his predecessor, a colored card was poking up from the hat band like an old-fashioned reporter's press pass, only this one wasn't yellow or orange or black. It was green.
"Thank God," he said.
He took one of my hands in both of his and squeezed it. The flesh of his palms was almost as cold as the air. I pulled back from him, but gently. I sensed no danger about him, only that thin and insistent desperation. Although that in itself might be dangerous. It might be as keen as the blade of the knife John Clayton had used on Sadie's face.
"Who are you?" I asked. "And why do you call me Jimla?"
"Jimla Doo is a long way from here, mister."
"I don't know who Jimla Doo is," the green card man said. "I've stayed away from your string as much as..."
He stopped. His face contorted. The sides of his hands rose to his temples and pressed there as if to hold his brains in. But it was the card, stuck in the band of his hat, that captured most of my attention. The color wasn't entirely fixed. For a moment, it swirled and swam, reminding me of the screensaver that takes over my computer after it's been idle for 15 minutes or so. The green swirled into a pale canary yellow. Then, as he slowly lowered his hands, it returned to green, but maybe not as bright a green as when I'd first noticed it.
"I've stayed away from your string as much as possible," the man in the black overcoat said, "but it hasn't been entirely possible. Besides, there are so many strings now, thanks to you and your friend the cook. There's so much crap."
"I don't understand any of this," I said. But that wasn't quite true. I could at least figure out the card this man and his wet-brained forerunner carried. They were like the badges worn by people who worked in nuclear power plants. Only, instead of measuring radiation, the cards monitored what? Sanity? Green, your bag of marbles was full. Yellow, you'd started to lose them. Orange, call for the men in the white coats, and when your card turned black... The green card man was watching me, carefully. From across the street, he'd looked no older than 30. Over here, he looked closer to 45. Only, when you got close enough to look into his eyes, he looked older than the ages and not right in the head. "Are you some kind of guardian? Do you guard the rabbit hole?" He smiled, or tried to.
"That's what your friend called it."
From his pocket, he took a pack of cigarettes. There was no label on them. That was something I'd never seen before, either here in the land of a go or in the land of a head. "Is this the only one?" He produced a lighter, cupped it to keep the wind from blowing the flame out, then set fire to the end of his cigarette. The smell was sweet, more like marijuana than tobacco. But it wasn't marijuana. Although he never said, I believe it was something medicinal, perhaps not so different from my Goody's headache powder.
"There are a few. Think of a glass of ginger ale that's been left out and forgotten."
"Okay."
"After 2 or 3 days, almost all the carbonation is gone, but there are still a few bubbles left. What you call the rabbit hole isn't a hole at all. It's a bubble. As far as guarding, no, not really. It would be nice, but there's very little we could do that wouldn't make things worse. That's the trouble with traveling in time, Jimla."
"My name is Jake."
"Fine. What we do, Jake, is watch. Sometimes we warn, as Kyle tried to warn your friend, the cook." So the crazy guy had a name. A perfectly normal one. Kyle, for God's sake.
It made things worse because it made them more real. He never tried to warn Al. All he ever did was ask for a buck to buy cheap wine with. The green card man dragged on his cigarette and looked down at the cracked concrete, frowning, as if something were written there.
"Shatush! Shatush!" said the weaving flats.
"He did it first," he said, "in his way. Your friend was too excited by the new world he'd found to pay attention. And by then, Kyle was already tottering. It's a, how would you put it, an occupational hazard. What we do puts us under enormous mental strain. Do you know why?"
I shook my head.
"Think a minute. How many little explorations and shopping trips did your cook friend make even before he got the idea of going to Dallas to stop Oswald? 50? 100? 200?
I tried to remember how long Al's diner had stood in the mill courtyard, and couldn't. Probably even more than that.
"And what did he tell you? Each trip was the first time?"
"Yes, a complete reset."
He laughed.
wearily.
Sure he did. People believe what they see, and still he should have known better. You should have known better. Each trip creates its own string. And when you have enough strings, they always get snarled. Did it ever cross your friend's mind to wonder how he could buy the same meat over and over? Or why things he brought from 1958 never disappeared when he made the next trip?
I asked him about that. He didn't know. So he dismissed it. He started to smile, but it turned into a wince. The green, once more, started to fade out of the card stuck in his hat. He dragged deep on his sweet-smelling cigarette. The color returned and steadied.
Yeah, ignoring the obvious is what we all do. Even after his sanity began to totter, Kyle undoubtedly knew that his trips to yonder liquor store were making his condition worse, but he went on regardless. I don't blame him. I'm sure the wine eased his pain, especially toward the end. Things might have been better if he hadn't been able to get to the liquor store, if it was outside the circle, but it wasn't. And really, who can say? There is no blaming here, Jake. No condemnation.
That was good to hear, but only because it meant we could converse about this lunatic subject like halfway rational men. Not that his feelings mattered much to me either way. I still had to do what I had to do. What's your name?
Zach Lang, from Seattle, originally.
Seattle when?
It's a question with no relevance to the current discussion.
It hurts you to be here, doesn't it?
Yes. My own sanity won't last much longer if I don't get back, and the residual effects will be with me forever. High suicide rate among our kind, Jake, very high. Men, and we are men, not aliens or supernatural beings, if that's what you were thinking, aren't made to hold multiple reality strings in their heads. It's not like using your imagination. It's not like that at all. We have training, of course, but you can still feel it eating into you like acid.
So every trip isn't a complete reset?
Yes and no. It leaves residue. Every time your cook friend...
His name was Al.
Yes, I suppose I knew that. But my memory has started to break down. It's like Alzheimer's, only it's not Alzheimer's. It's because the brain can't help trying to reconcile all those thin overlays of reality. The strings create multiple images of the future. Some are clear, most are hazy. That's probably why Kyle thought your name was Jimla. He must have heard it along one of the strings.
He didn't hear it, I thought. He saw it on some kind of string-o-vision on a billboard in Texas. Maybe even through my eyes.
You don't know how lucky you are, Jake. For you, time travel is simple.
Not all that simple, I thought. There were paradoxes, I said. All kinds of them, weren't there?
No, that's the wrong word. It's residue. Didn't I just tell you that?
He honestly didn't seem sure.
It gums up the machine. Eventually, a point will come where the machine simply stops.
I thought of how the engine had blown in the Studebaker Sadie and I had stolen.
Buying meat over and over again in 1958 wasn't so bad, Zach Lang said. Oh, it was causing trouble down the line, but it was bearable. Then the big changes started. Saving Kennedy was the biggest of all.
I tried to speak and couldn't.
Are you beginning to understand?
Not entirely, but I could see the general outline, and it scared the living hell out of me. The future was on strings. Like a puppet. Good God. The earthquake? I did cause it. When I saved Kennedy, I... What? Ripped the time-space continuum? That should have come out sounding stupid, but it didn't. It sounded very grave. My head began to throb.
You need to go back now, Jake. He spoke gently. You need to go back and see exactly what you've done. What all your hard and no doubt well-meaning work has accomplished.
I said nothing. I had been worried about going back, but now I was afraid as well. Is there any phrase more ominous than you need to see exactly what you've done? I couldn't think of one offhand.
Go, have a look. Spend a little time, but only a little. If this isn't put right soon, there's going to be a catastrophe.
How big?
He spoke calmly.
It could destroy everything.
The world? The solar system? I had to put my hand on the side of the drying shed to hold myself up. The galaxy? The universe?
Bigger than that.
He paused, wanting to make sure I understood. The card in his hatband swirled, turned yellow, swirled back toward green.
Reality itself.
I walked to the chain. The sign reading no admittance beyond this point until sewer pipe is repaired squeaked in the wind. I looked back at Zach Lang, that traveler from who knew when. He looked at me without expression, the hem of his black overcoat flapping around his shins. Lang? The harmonies. I caused them all, didn't I? He might have nodded. I'm not sure. The past fought change because it was destructive to the future. Change created... I thought of an old ad for Memorex audio tape. It showed a crystal glass being shattered by sound vibrations, by pure harmonics. And with every change I succeeded in making, those harmonies increased. That's the real danger, isn't it? Those fucking harmonies? No answer. Perhaps he had known and forgotten. Perhaps he had never known at all. Easy, I told myself, as I had 5 years before when the first strands of gray had yet to show up in my hair. Just take it easy. I ducked under the chain, my left knee yipping, then stood for a second with the high green side of the drying shed on my left. This time there was no chunk of concrete to mark the spot where the invisible stairs began. How far away from the chain had they been? I couldn't remember. I walked slowly, slowly, my shoes gritting on the cracked concrete. Shat-hoosh! Shat-hoosh! Said the weaving flats, and then, as I took my sixth step and the seventh, the sound changed to too far. Too far. I took another step, then another. Soon I'd reach the end of the drying shed and be in the courtyard beyond it. It was gone. The bubble had burst. I took one more step, and although there was no stair riser, for just a moment, I saw my shoe as a double exposure. It was on the concrete, but it was also on dirty green linoleum. I took another step, and I was a double exposure. Most of my body was standing beside the Warumbo Mill drying shed in late November of 1963, but part of me was somewhere else. And it wasn't the pantry of Al's Diner. What if I came out not in Maine, not even on Earth, but in some strange other dimension? Some place with a crazy red sky and air that would poison my lungs, and stop my heart. I looked back again. Lang stood there with his coat whipping in the wind. There was still no expression on his face.
You're on your own, that empty face seemed to say. I can't make you do anything.
It was true, but unless I went through the rabbit hole into the land of ahead, I wouldn't be able to come back to the land of ago, and Sadie would stay dead forever. I closed my eyes and managed one more step. Suddenly, I could smell faint ammonia and some other, more unpleasant odor. After you'd crossed the country at the rear of a lot of Greyhound buses, that second smell was unmistakable. It was the unlovely aroma of a toilet cubicle that needed a lot more than a Glade air freshener on the wall to sweeten it up. Eyes closed, I took one more step and heard that weird popping sound inside my head. I opened my eyes and I was in a small, filthy bathroom. There was no toilet. It had been removed, leaving nothing but the dirty shadow of its footing. An ancient urine cake, faded from its bright blue operating color to a listless gray, lay in the corner. Ants marched back and forth over it. The corner I'd come out in was blocked off by cartons filled with empty bottles and cans. It reminded me of Lee's shooter's nest. I pushed a couple of the boxes aside and eased my way into the little room. I started for the door, then restacked the cartons. No sense making it easy for anyone to stumble down the rabbit hole by mistake. Then I stepped outside and back into 2011. It had been dark the last time I'd gone down the rabbit hole, so of course it was dark now, because it was only 2 minutes later. A lot had changed in those 2 minutes, though. I could see that even in the gloom. At some point in the last 48 years, the mill had burned down. All that remained were a few blackened walls, a fallen stack that reminded me, inevitably, of the one I'd seen at the site of the Kitchener Ironworks and Dairy, and several piles of rubble. There was no sign of your main snuggery, L.L. Bean Express, or any other upscale shops. Here was a wrecked mill standing on the banks of the Androscoggin. Nothing else. On the June night when I'd left, on my 5-year mission to save Kennedy, the temperature had been pleasantly mild. Now it was beastly hot. I took off the sheepskin-lined coat I'd bought in Auburn and tossed it into the ill-smelling bathroom. When I closed the door again, I saw the sign on it. Bathroom out of order. No toilet. Sewer pipe is broken. Beautiful young presidents died, and beautiful young presidents lived. Beautiful young women lived, and then they died. But the broken sewer pipe beneath the courtyard of the old Warumbo Mill was apparently eternal. The chain was still there, too. I walked to it along the flank of the dirty old cinder block building that had replaced the drying shed. When I ducked under the chain and went around to the front of the building, I saw it was an abandoned convenience store called Quick Flash. The windows were shattered, and all the shelves had been taken away. The place was nothing but a shell, where one emergency light, its battery almost dead, buzzed like a dying fly against a winter window pane. There was graffiti spray-painted on the remains of the floor and just enough light to read it. Get out of town, you packy bastard! I walked across the broken concrete of the courtyard. The lot where the mill workers had once parked was gone. Nothing had been built there. It was just a vacant rectangle, filled with smashed bottles, jigsaw chunks of old asphalt, and listless clumps of trash grass. Used condoms hung from some of these, like ancient party streamers. I looked up for stars and saw none. The sky was covered with low-hanging clouds, just thin enough to allow a little vague moonlight to seep through. The blinker at the intersection of Main Street and Route 196, once known as the old Lewiston Road, had been replaced at some point by a traffic light, but it was dark. That was all right. There was no traffic in either direction. The fruit was gone. There was a cellar hole where it had stood. Across from it where the Green Front had been in 1958, and where a bank should have been standing in